who was bending to him, turning him onto his back.
"Watch out!"
cried Onofrio. Esteban let himself be turned and lashed out with the machete. His contempt for Onofrio and Encarnacion, as well as his hatred for Raimundo, was involved in the blow, and the blade lodged deep in Raimundo's side, grating on bone. Raimundo shrieked and would have fallen, but the blade helped to keep him upright. His hands fluttered around the machete, as if he wanted to adjust it to a more comfortable position, and his eyes were wide with disbelief. A shudder vibrated the hilt of the machete. It seemed sensual, the spasm of a spent passion, and Raimundo sank to his knees. Blood spilled from his mouth, adding tragic lines to the corners of his lips. He pitched forward, not falling flat but remaining kneeling, his face pressed into the sand, the attitude of an Arab at prayer. Esteban wrenched the machete free, fearful of an attack by Onofrio, but the appliance dealer was squirming into the Land Rover. The engine caught, the wheels spun, and the car lurched off, turning through the edge of the surf and heading for Puerto Morata. An orange dazzle flared on the rear window, as if the spirit who had lured it to the barrio was now harrying it away. Unsteadily, Esteban got to his feet. He peeled his shirt back from the bullet wound. There was a lot of blood, but it was only a crease. He avoided looking at Raimundo, and walked down to the water, and stood gazing out at the waves. His thoughts rolled in with him, less thoughts than tidal sweeps of emotion. It was twilight by the time Miranda returned, her arms full of bananas and wild figs. She had not heard the shot. He told her what had happened, and she dressed his wounds with a poultice of herbs and banana leaves.
"It will mend," she said of the wound. "But this," she gestured at Raimundo, "this will not. You must come with me, Esteban. The soldiers will kill you."
"No," he said. "They will come, but they are Patuca, except for the captain, who is a drunkard, a shell of a man. I doubt he will even be notified. They will listen to my story, and we will reach an accommodation. No matter what lies Onofrio tells, his word will not stand against theirs."
"And then?"
"I may have to go to jail for a while, or I may have to leave the province, but I will not be killed." She sat for a minute without speaking, the whites of her eyes glowing in the half-light. Finally she stood and walked off along the beach. "Where are you going?" he called. She turned back.
"You speak so casually of losing me," she began.
"It is not casual."
"No,"
she laughed bitterly.
"I suppose not. You are so afraid of life. You call it death, and would prefer jail or exile to living it. That is hardly casual."
She stared at him, her expression a cipher at that distance.
"I will not lose you, Esteban," she said.
She walked away again, and this time, when he called, she did not return. Twilight deepened to dusk, a slow fill of shadow graying the world into negative, and Esteban felt himself graying along with it, his thoughts reduced to echoing the dull wash of the receding tide. The dusk lingered, and he had the idea that night would never fall, that the act of violence had driven a nail through the substance of his irresolute life, pinned him forever to this ashen moment and deserted shore. As a child, he had been terrified by the possibility of such magical isolations, but now the prospect seemed a consolation for Miranda's absence, a remembrance of her magic. Despite her parting words, he did not think she would be back. There had been sadness and finality in her voice, and this roused in him feelings of both relief and desolation, feelings that set him to pacing up and down the tidal margin of the shore. The full moon rose, the sands of the barrio burned silver, and shortly thereafter four soldiers came in a jeep from Puerto Morata. They were gnomish, copper-skinned men, and their uniforms were the dark blue of the night sky, bearing no device or decoration. Though they were not close friends, he knew them each by name: Sebastian, Amador, Carlito, and Ramon. In their headlights, Raimundo's corpse, startlingly pale, the blood on his face dried into intricate whorls, looked like an exotic creature cast up by the sea, and their inspection of it smacked more of curiosity than of a search for evidence. Amador unearthed Raimundo's gun, sighted along it toward the jungle, and asked Ramon how much he thought it was worth.
"Perhaps Onofrio will give you a good price,"
said Ramon, and the others laughed. They built a fire of driftwood and coconut shells, and sat around it while Esteban told his story. He did not mention either Miranda or her relation to the Jaguar, because these men, estranged from the tribe by their government service, had grown conservative in their judgments, and he did not want them to consider him irrational. They listened without comment. The firelight burnished their skins to reddish gold and glinted on their rifle barrels.
"Onofrio will take his charge to the capital if we do nothing," said Amador, after Esteban had finished.
"He may in any case," said Carlito, "and then it will go hard with Esteban."
"And," said Sebastian, "if an agent is sent to Puerto Morada and sees how things are with Captain Portales, they will surely replace him, and it will go hard with us."
They stared into the flames, mulling over the problem, and Esteban chose the moment to ask Amador, who lived near him on the mountain, if he had seen Encarnacion.
"She will be amazed to learn you are alive," said Amador. "I saw her yesterday in the dressmaker's shop. She was admiring the fit of a new black skirt in the mirror."
It was as if a black swath of Encarnacion's skirt had folded around Esteban's thoughts. He lowered his head and carved lines in the sand with the point of his machete.
"I have it," said Ramon. "A boycott."
The others expressed confusion.
"If we do not buy from Onofrio, who will?" said Ramon. "He will lose his business. Threaten with this, he will not dare involve the government. He will allow Esteban to plead self-defense."
"But Raimundo was his only son," said Amador. "It may be that grief will count more than greed in this instance."
Again they fell silent. It mattered little to Esteban what was decided. He was coming to understand that without Miranda, his future held nothing but uninteresting choices. He turned his gaze to the sky and noticed that the stars and the fire were flickering with the same rhythm, and he imagined each of them ringed by a group of gnomish copper-skinned men, debating the question of his fate.
"Aha,"
said Carlito.
"I know what to do. We will occupy Barrio Carolina, the entire company, and we will kill the Jaguar. Onofrio's greed cannot withstand this temptation."
"That you must not do," said Esteban.
"But why?"
asked Amador.
"We may not kill the Jaguar, but with so many men we will certainly drive it away."
Before Esteban could answer, the Jaguar roared. It was prowling down the beach toward the fire, like a black flame itself, shifting over the glowing sand. Its ears were laid back, and silver drops of moonlight gleamed in its eyes. Amador grabbed his rifle, came to one knee, and fired. The bullet sprayed sand a dozen feet to the left of the Jaguar.
"Wait!"
cried Esteban, pushing him down. But the rest had begun to fire, and the Jaguar was hit. It leaped high as it had that first night while playing, but this time it landed in a heap, snarling, snapping at its shoulder. It regained its feet and limped toward the jungle, favoring its right foreleg. Excited by their success, the soldiers ran a few paces after it and stopped to fire again. Carlito dropped to one knee, taking careful aim.
"No!"
shouted Esteban. And as he hurled his machete at Carlito, desperate to prevent further harm to Miranda, he recognized the trap that had been sprung and the consequences he would face. The blade sliced across Carlito's thigh, knocking him onto his side. He screamed, and Amador, seeing what had happened, fired wildly at Esteban and called to the others. Esteban ran toward the jungle, making for the Jaguar's path. A fusillade of shots rang out behind him. Bullets whipped past his ears. Each time his feet slipped in the soft sand, the moonstruck facades of the barrio appeared to lurch sideways, as if trying to block his way. And then, as he reached the verge of the jungle, he was hit. The bullet seemed to throw him forward, to increase his speed, but somehow he managed to keep his feet. He careened along the path, arms waving, breath shrieking in his throat. Palmetto fronds swatted his face, vines tangled his legs. He felt no pain, only a peculiar numbness that pulsed low in his back. He pictured the wound opening and closing like the mouth of an anemone.
The soldiers were shouting his name. They would follow, but cautiously, afraid of the jaguar. And he thought he might be able to cross the river before they could catch up. But when he came to the river, he found the jaguar waiting. It was crouched on the tussocky rise, its neck craned over the water, and below, half a dozen feet from the bank, floated the reflection of the full moon, huge and silvery, an unblemished circle of light. Blood glistened scarlet on the jaguar's shoulder, like a fresh rose pinned in place, and this made it look even more an embodiment of principle, the shape a god might choose, that some universal constant might assume. It gazed calmly at Esteban, growled low in its throat, and dove into the river, cleaving and shattering the moon's reflection, vanishing beneath the surface. The ripples subsided, the image of the moon reformed, and there, silhouetted against it, Esteban saw the figure of a woman swimming, each stroke causing her to grow smaller and smaller, until she seemed no more than a character incised upon a silver plate. It was not only Miranda he saw, but all mystery and beauty receding from him, and he realized how blind he had been, not to perceive the truth sheathed inside the truth of death that had been sheathed inside her truth of another world. It was clear to him now. It sang to him from his wound, every syllable a heartbeat. It was written by the dying ripples. It swayed in the banana leaves. It sighed on the wind. It was everywhere, and he had always known it. If you deny mystery, even in the guise of death, then you deny life, and you will walk like a ghost through your days, never knowing the secrets of the extremes, the deep sorrows, the absolute joys. He drew a breath of the rank jungle air, and with it drew a breath of a world no longer his, of the girl Encarnacion, of friends and children and country knights, all his lost sweetness. His chest tightened as with the onset of tears, but the sensation quickly abated, and he understood that the sweetness of the past had been subsumed by a scent of mangoes, that 9 magical days, a magical number of days, the number it takes to sing the soul to rest, lay between him and tears. Freed of those associations, he felt as if he were undergoing a subtle refinement of form, a winnowing, and he remembered having felt much the same on the day when he had run out the door of Santa Maria dell'Onda, putting behind him its dark geometries and cobwebbed catechisms, and generations of swallows that had never flown beyond the walls, casting off his acolyte's robe and racing across the square toward the mountain and Encarnacion. It had been she who had lured him then, just as his mother had lured him to the church, and as Miranda was luring him now. And he laughed at seeing how easily these 3 women had diverted the flow of his life, how like other men he was in this. The strange bloom of painlessness in his back was sending out tendrils into his arms and legs, and the cries of the soldiers had grown louder. Miranda was a tiny speck shrinking against a silver immensity. For a moment he hesitated, experiencing a resurgence of fear. Then Miranda's face materialized in his mind's eye, and all the emotion he had suppressed for 9 days poured through him, washing away the fear. It was a silvery, flawless emotion, and he was giddy with it, light with it. It was like thunder and fire fused into one element and boiling up inside him, and he was overwhelmed by a need to express it, to mold it into a form that would reflect its power and purity. But he was no singer, no poet. There was but a single mode of expression open to him, hoping he was not too late, that Miranda's door had not shut forever. Esteban dove into the river, cleaving the image of the full moon, and, his eyes still closed from the shock of the splash, with the last of his mortal strength, he swam hard down after her. Arthur's Lion, Tanith Lee.
Tanith Lee has written nearly 100 books and over 270 short stories, as well as radio plays and TV scripts. Her genre crossing combines fantasy, science fiction, horror, young adult, historical, detective, and contemporary fiction. Her latest publications include The Lion Wolf Trilogy, Cast a Bright Shadow, Here in Cold Hell, and No Flame But Mine, and the three Piratica novels for young adults. She has also recently published several short stories and novellas in Asimov's science fiction, Weird Tales, Realms of Fantasy, The Ghost Quartet, and Wizards. Nori Lana Books is reprinting all of her Flat Earth series, with two new volumes to follow. Leith Press will be reprinting the Esther Garber lesbian fiction, plus a new collection of gay lesbian short stories, including all new tales by Esther, her brother Judas, and even myself. She lives on the Sussex Weald with her husband, writer-artist John Kane, and two omnipresent cats. More information can be found at www.tanithlee.com. About the story, Lee says, "Arthur's lion arrived from a sort of semi-waking dream I experienced one morning. The background scenario, including the narrator, had also arrived by breakfast time. The direction of the story, too, though, was ultimately a surprise."
That year, I had some business to see to in Kent, and it wasn't long after arranging this that I received the letter from my uncle. It came as a surprise. At first, I hadn't the faintest idea who was writing to me so familiarly. When I realized, I was in two minds, but curiosity got the upper hand. I had better explain that I was nephew only to one uncle, Arthur, the brother of my then-deceased male parent. Arthur had made a lot of money in the north of England, as my mother had been wont to say, by exploiting the workers and putting them into marmalade. This had always been the joke, that Uncle Arthur had made a fortune in marmalade, some exotic variety which, I'm pretty certain, never appeared on our table. Frankly, once I'd grown up and moved into my own life, I may well here and there have eaten the fabulous spread and not known it. Basically, Arthur had removed himself from the family early on, and never afterwards himself maintained any contact. My father had seen his brother last in childhood. I was only 5 when he took himself off, but I always remember he was a funny chap, said my father. Peculiar things stick in your mind, even when you can't recall what they were all about. The peculiar Arthurian thing which had stuck, apparently, concerned an Arthur then 16 years of age, letting out a loud cry and promptly fainting to the ground. We were in some sort of park. I think it was a park. We were going somewhere, but there was such a fuss we didn't go. I've no memory as to where. All I recollect is Arthur yelling at the top of his lungs and sprawling on the gravel path.
Perhaps, postulated my mother, it was the first time making a fortune in marmalade occurred to him.
In fact, though Arthur did become extremely rich, it formed a dark mark on his escutcheon that none of this wealth was ever put in the way either of my grandparents, or my father's family, of which it seemed Arthur had been told. Arthur's contemporary letter, however, when it reached me, was friendly and warm in tone. He said that he had come across my name in a promotion in the local newspapers, relating to the theatrical performance because of which I was going down to Kent. Since our name is rather unusual, he had decided it must be me, and an inquiry at a London theatre provided him my address. The substance of his letter was to invite me to stay with him at his house. This was, he assured me, only 3 miles from my business venue, and his chauffeur would, of course, drive me in each day and retrieve me in the evening. Arthur was sure, besides, I would appreciate the comforts of a house over an inn, and added that he sincerely hoped I would visit him. We had been estranged too long. Initially, I tossed the letter in the wastepaper bin, but then, as I say, curiosity won me round. By that era in my life, I was involved in work I found both fascinating and highly remunerative. So Arthur's fortune had no allure. But I'd heard of the house, which I will call Blue Furs, a place, it seemed, of luxury. And I confess I wondered very much what Arthur would be like, if at all like my father, or even myself. I therefore rescued his letter and replied in the affirmative. The next morning, I traveled down to Kent. It was a mild October afternoon when I arrived at Kesslington Station. Arthur's huge, shining car, complete with respectful driver, picked me up and bore me away down autumnal lanes thick with yellow foliage and cows peering across gates. Blue Firs was a large house, if by no means a mansion. It had been built in the 1800s for someone or other's mistress. Enormous trees framed the views as we drove up through the grounds, and there gradually appeared a cream and rose facade, with pillarings and tall windows. Long roofs, with sun-gilded red tiles, had put up the periscopes of rather charming ornamental chimneys, modelled on an earlier design. I could imagine my mother saying,
"Ah, the house built of marmalade."
When I'd gone inside, I found myself in one of those polished echoing halls, whose acoustics are normally so bad for actors. A whisper carries like an unintelligible roar, and a roar like a rumble. I asked the housekeeper if my uncle was about. She told me he was lying down but would meet me at the drinks hour. I went to unpack. It seemed Arthur hadn't, after all, lost his social gracelessness, at least where it could be applied to relatives. But my room was large and airy, with a fire laid ready for later, and the great bed comfortable, and the bathroom well appointed. Someone had also supplied gin, whiskey, and soda, and a bowl of hothouse oranges. Not so bad. When I went down at 6, a butler showed me at once into a long, narrow drawing room that looked out across the lawn. No one else was there.
"Is my uncle coming down?" I asked, rather impatiently.
"Yes, sir. He'll be here directly."
"Are there other guests for dinner?"
"No, sir." Left alone, I sat by the fireside, watching the brown shadows gather over the room, and the bluer ones fill in the sweep of grass and trees outside. I felt, and now for the first I admitted it, distinctly uneasy. Was I worried then to be confronting my peculiar uncle? Or was it the big quaint house? I thought not. Already once or twice I had stayed with various theatrical royalty, and been in buildings far more eccentric and grandly expanded. Besides, I have never been the nervous type. Even first nights move me only to extra diligence. A cool head. I've been mocked for it. The shadows thickened. I got up and switched on a pair of lamps, and turning again, saw the light reflecting on a short, stocky man, formally dressed for dinner, standing in the wide doorway and staring at me with enormous eyes. It struck me extraordinarily. He was most like a child, an anxious child. I had the urge to put him at his ease, and too the wild notion he was truly frightened, scared at meeting at last this alien nephew, son to a brother he had barely troubled to know. What did I call him? I decided on mundane family courtesy. "Uncle Arthur?"
"Oh," he said, "Arthur. We're both past the age of needing uncle shoved in. And you must be..."
He named me. And I found myself saying kindly,
"Oh, please, call me Jack. It's what I generally answer to with friends." "I hope we shall be," he said.
"I hope so, too." He stole forward. No other way to describe it. We shook hands. He was warm enough, but slightly stiff and swiftly withdrawn. He then came to the fire and stood there, lit by the flames and the lamps, his melancholy gaze now on the hearth and now, in fleeting glimpses, on me. Neither of us sat down. Finally, he glanced at the drink in my hand, but didn't seem to want one for himself. Suddenly he said,
"You must think it odd, my contacting you like that, out of the blue."
It was a pleasant surprise. He looked away from me then, discounting, I thought, the shallowness of my reply. He looked instead at the dark lawn beyond the window, and the trees, heavy with a new night.
"Don't you think," he said, "this lighted room is like a camp in some jungle place, or on some open plain? A fire, a pair of lamps. Anything might be there," he said strangely, "beyond the light."
"Do you mean in your grounds?"
"I suppose. No, not in the grounds. Nothing's there."
Somewhere from the depths of the house there came at that moment a long, indefinite sound. It was, I thought, the timbers shifting at the chill of the evening, but Arthur looked round now at it, scanning the doorway, as if he expected someone, something, to appear. He seemed less startled, though a little startled, then apprehensively resigned. At that second moment, too, something did move into or over the doorway. It was a large, bulky shadow, reeling across the duller lighting of the hall, and it was instantly followed by its cause. The butler filled the doorframe.
"Have you locked up?"
asked Arthur, rather breathlessly, I thought.
"Yes, sir. All but the usual door."
"Good. That's good."
The butler then spoke about the dinner arrangements, which sounded ordinary enough, that a report seemed unnecessary. Arthur must be a very pedantic and unsettled man. I pondered also why the house had been locked so early, and why the usual door was not. Perhaps to let particular servants who didn't sleep over at the house return to the village? When the butler again went out, he left the drawing room door wide open. Looking after him quite idly, I saw that flowing shadow veer again along the hallway. This time, it seemed not to match his movements, nor that of anything in the room. But firelight can play tricks. In any case, Arthur now sat down, and I with him. He helped himself to a drink and me to another. And then at last, in the expected way of relatives, he began to question me about my father and mother, our past life, my present one, and so on, until a maid came to call us to dine. The meal was very good, with local fish and roast, and a wonderful sugary dessert concocted by Arthur's cook. All through the courses he seemed fairly relaxed, and only once got the jitters. For some reason I couldn't fathom at all, but he swallowed another glass of wine and cheered up again. We went into an old-fashioned smoking room after dinner, with the brandy and cigarettes. It was a tradition of Arthur's, because smoking otherwise was permitted everywhere about the house. The velvet curtains were drawn, and another fire sparkled. Everything, all told, was very appealing and comfortable. Had it not been for the constant sense of unease and alertness, most like a vague, almost undetectable smell, that also hung over virtually every instant. Even Arthur's relaxed periods had begun to seem forced. What was bothering him? I had come to the conclusion, whatever it was, it would be the very same matter that had prompted him to invite me to his home. I'm afraid I felt quite irritable at this. Once tomorrow dawned, I would have my hands full with the theatrical event in the town, and little time for sudden extra dramas. Throughout dinner we'd spoken only of trivial things, mostly to do with the family. Arthur had remarked that I resembled my grandfather, when young, which I valued. In him, although I didn't say so, I could see no likeness to any of our tribe. Once in the smoking room, a silence drifted down. We sat in armchairs, and Arthur stared long into the fire, and I thought, by now highly apprehensive myself, any minute and he'll come out with it, whatever the hell it is, and then let's hope it can be put right very simply. Otherwise it must wait until the play is done. Arthur said again,
"Yes, I can see my father in you. My brother must have grown to be a strong, well-set-up young man. I know he can have been afraid of absolutely nothing. As a little child, even, he was fearless. I remember his nanny, the very woman who had terrified me as a child with her ghost stories, having no effect on him whatsoever." I said, "Yes, he was a brave man. I've seen as much from his war record." "Indeed. But I suppose," said Arthur softly, "we are all of us, in the end, afraid of something. Otherwise, could we be human?"
"Certainly I'm terrified of several things. The British tax system, for one thing. Oh, and I admit, a certain well-known actress who shall be nameless." Arthur smiled, but the smile slipped off like water. His face was closed in, bent to the fire, his eyes viewing, it seemed, only that.
"Yes, but there are other fears, aren't there? Inner fears. Fears located, how do they say it now, within the id?"
I said nothing. This promised to be more weird and much more time-consuming than I'd supposed. Arthur stirred the fire slowly with a poker. Then he sat there, holding the poker loosely in his hand.
"Since I was a boy," he said, "since then, about 6 years of age, something, I saw it first in a book. One of those stupid, highly colored old illustrated books for children. Though I'd guess now it was meant for a much older child than I then was. It was on a low table in the library. Thinking back, I believe it must have been my father's property when he was little. Had it terrified him? Apparently not. And why, anyway, was it lying out open where I could find it? I've often wondered that. I'd think, really, almost any child might have been frightened by it. The drawn picture was very crude, all reds, yellows, blacks, horrible.
He raised his eyes straight up to mine, and they were full of utter terror that glowed like tears.
I know now it was a book about ancient Rome, and this picture concerned the Emperor Nero's habit of having Christians thrown into the arena and savage, hungry animals let loose on them. An awful subject to illustrate. Probably meant to be improving. But me, it did not improve, I rather think.
He lowered the poker slowly back into its place.
It ruined me.
I was then, and am, no psychiatrist. I said, no doubt with inappropriate foolishness. Of course, as a child, you might be afraid at it. But how can it have ruined you?
I've been quite a bold little boy, always in scrapes. Brave. I used to lead a little local gang. We had some piratical name. But after I saw in that book, after I saw that picture, a change came over me. I used to dream, you see. I used to dream over and over about that picture.
The Christians being killed in the arena by the animals.
Killed and devoured, yes, they were.
He hesitated, and the oddest small twist of a smile distorted his lips.
They were lions, he said,
and then again,
lions.
As if to repeat the name took a great effort of will, which he must exert. Something in how he had stirred the fire had upset the logs. It sank and darkened, and the room seemed to darken too, despite the electric lamps. I said encouragingly, "Well, what you describe could be enough to give any kid nightmares."
"Perhaps, but I must explain. My dreams were very specific. I was in the arena, you see, I as a child, and I was alone. Alone, that was, but for a huge, formless, faceless crowd shouting and baying all around me from the seats. And I would stand there on the sand, naked, shivering and afraid, sickeningly afraid. And then a kind of black hole would come in the side of the arena, and a lion would come out. Only one, you see. Only one."
Arthur stopped. He put his head into his hands, but not before I'd seen his face was now almost green. "Don't go on if it distresses."
"I must go on," he said.
He lifted his head and brought his brandy to his mouth and gulped the lot.
"One lion," he said. "I know him so well. A huge ochre beast with a vast black ruffed head. There were bloody welts on his side. They must have whipped him up from the cages below. That filthy book showed all that too. Each of his eyes were like yellow-red coals. He stank. I could smell him. He stank of butcher's meat. And then he ran towards me, right at me, and I stood there screaming. And as he leaped, his great claws flashed like silver hooks. And I woke, always I woke, just before his weight could come down and his talons and teeth could go into me, always, and always screaming. It happened every night, yet only ever once, once every night. It happened once every night for a whole year. I was afraid to go to bed. I would make myself keep awake, sitting up in the darkness, but in the end always I fell asleep. And then I'd be in the arena, alone but for the crowd, and he would come, the lion. And he would run and leap, and in that split second, when the rush of his stinking flesh and his claws already felt like a boiling wind across my body, I'd wake up. I would escape him.
My God, I said. Finally, I thought, the elements of his fear had truly communicated themselves to me. As with a powerful acting performance, the catharsis of emphatically induced emotion. I was shaken.
"Well," Arthur said presently, "I must tell you why the dreams stopped. First, my parents tried to laugh and tease me out of them. Then they tried to bully me out. You perhaps have wondered why I've been a stranger to my own family all these years. Partly it began there.
I never forgave them for it, their crass lack of understanding. And though in later years I could grasp almost perfectly that it came not from cruelty, but from a genuine if entirely misplaced conception of how best to deal with me, the rift had widened and was too enormous to heal. However long before that, when I was 7 years old, I met a gypsy in our garden. He just walked in at the gate and was going round to the back of the house with some tinker stuff he'd got for the kitchen. But seeing me, he pulled a face and then called to me, quite politely and gently, "Come here, young master." That was what he said, and for some reason to him I went. I was by then a thin, pale-faced child, with rings under my eyes from never sleeping well. I must have looked haunted enough. Our doctor had already apparently warned my father I might be in the early stages of some incurable malady, which idea alarmed mother, but my father scoffed at it, saying I was just in a silly mood, trying still to be a baby, and waking everyone by yelling every night. But the gypsy man stared into my face, and then he said, "I can make him go away. One day, he will come back. But you'll be a man then, and perhaps a man will have the strength to turn him off for good." I gaped at him, and because I'd been brought up a certain way, I feebly said to him, "What do you mean?" "Hush now," he answered. Then he put his hand on my head. It felt scalding hot, this hand, and he breathed in my face, and his breath was bad because I suppose, poor fellow, his teeth weren't up to much, but somehow that didn't repulse me. When he lifted his hand away, I felt something go with it. He said, "Done now. Not till you're a man will it come back. Go and tell the cook you took a toy off me from my sack, and I'm owed half a shilling." I did what he said, and later I received a smacking from my father, who told me off for making the cook pay for a paltry toy for me. He asked where the toy was. I said it had been broken, and my father said that served me right. He would have broken it if I had not. That night I crept up to bed and sat there in the dark as usual, my back sore from the blows and biting my hand to keep awake. But I kept thinking of the gypsy, too, and in the end I let go. I let go and I slept. I slept right through. It was the first night in a year I didn't have the dream, but after that, night followed night without it. Gradually then my general health improved. I was soon at school, and began to lead my own boy's life again, although I was never as I had been before I saw the book. I hadn't the stamina I had had, even though I'd grown older and bigger. I tended to weight rather than muscle. I had headaches and once or twice fainted, if I was too hot or too cold, and sometimes in church. But the dream was entirely gone. Gone till I should be a man and have the strength to face it once more, and then be able to send it away, to turn it off for good. Nevertheless, I could never be reconciled to that word, that name, or if I saw any picture of them, even a fine painting, or if it was in a lesson. In Latin, for example, I even fainted then too. Something in Suetonius, I think it was, about the Roman circus. The fire was dying. I took it on myself to poke at the logs and drop off another one. Arthur poured us more brandy, but said nothing. His face was less pallid, but had the greasy look of light sweating. When I straightened up, I said, "What happened then, when you were 16? "Oh," said Arthur, "your father remembered that, did he?" "Yes. It was nothing, really. Nothing for them. We were to visit a garden, a zoological garden. By that time, I'd got much better at suppressing my fear. Or I told myself I had. I'd been nerving myself to the excursion, thinking it might be a test I could overcome. But then, I heard them roaring, you see. In the distance, over the trees, lions. I knew instantly what the noise was. I screamed, as I had in my nightmares, and screaming is all I recollect after this, until I found myself at home again. I left my father's house as soon as I was well enough to do so. I led then quite an unadventurous life,
I won't bore you with the details. They bore me too, you see. Until that piece of luck with the recipe, the marmalade. More an orange jam, you understand. An old Scottish formula. Pure luck. Idiotic. But it made us rich, my partners and I. I can assure you, however, such good fortune doesn't hold off loneliness. I have always found it awkward to mix with people, to find companions, and so I have been a lonely man, unmarried, childless. I can't imagine such things as wedlock or paternity for myself. Even so, I have got by. I have lived. And now, he said. Arthur leant back in his chair as I sat down again in mine. And now, he repeated. Though never having myself walked out on the boards, save in the most administrative capacity, I found myself responding as if we two, he and I, were spotlit now at the center of a stage. Faultless on my cue, I announced. And now it has returned. Arthur met my eyes. His had changed to flat, dark stones. Yes, it has come back. As the gypsy said it would. As he said. Do you know why? Oh, yes. Something very ordinary. I leant forward. Which is? I saw the damnable picture again.
Good Lord, where? Where did you see it?
Oh, not in that vile little book. No, it was reproduced in a catalogue. It seems the ghastly work is now something of an antique, and this illustration, the particular one, the one I think was fashioned in hell for me alone, that picture has been reproduced in the brightest, gaudiest detail. Leafing carelessly through the catalogue in the house of a business associate, suddenly it was all before me again. I had to leave the house immediately, making some incredible excuse, I can't remember what. That night I tried to reason with myself, but it was no use whatsoever. I found myself at 2 a.m., wandering about with the whiskey decanter, afraid to go to bed, just as I had been, night after night when I was a child. In the end, of course, adult common sense propelled me to my room. I downed a final glass of whiskey and fell instantly asleep. Half an hour later, I woke half the servants with my shrieks. My poor housekeeper believed criminals had broken in and were murdering me. It might have been amusing if this state of affairs hadn't then continued for 6 further months. Yes, naturally, my doctor and then several specialists were summoned. They could do nothing, only drug me to a deathly moribund slumber from which, despite all the muck I had swallowed, I still woke once a night, screaming in terror. The lion. Arthur spoke the name now in a loud, clear stroke, like the movement of a surgeon's knife. The lion came for me, as he always had. Out of the dark hole in the arena wall, over the dirty sand leaping, his claws raking the air, just missing me as I sprang awake. I, too, lifted my glass and drained it. But, I said, 6 further months, I heard you say. Do you mean you found a way again to stop the dreams?
In a manner of speaking.
Arthur stared downwards into nothingness.
A last specialist arrived here 2 months ago. In his demeanor, he reminded me once more of my father, though he was younger than I am now, a strong-minded, bullying man, himself brave as... I was going to say brave as a lion. He told me roundly I was a nervous wreck, and that the fault lay only with me. I had let this literary phantasm prey on me, and had offered no resistance. To drug myself with morphine or liquor was past the point. I must instead lie down to sleep and face the beast, in the knowledge that it was nothing, nothing at all. It was only, he told me sternly, my own fear which had birthed and subsequently sustained the nightmare. Forgivable, he admitted, in a very young child, but in a grown man nauseating and absurd. It is your cowardice, he bluntly said, which is destroying your sleep, your health, and your life. You and you alone can be rid of it. You must cast it out. Then you will be free. When he'd quite done with me, I was trembling like a boy. But I could see, as I can see now, that he was fundamentally in the right. My terrors had formed this curse.
I must turn my back on them. And so I ate a light supper, had a couple of drinks, and went to bed. I stayed awake about half an hour, during which time I refused myself a single thought of the nightmare, and fell asleep abruptly. I dreamed of nothing at all. Since then, too, the dream hasn't plagued me once. Indeed, I can sleep at any hour of the day or night without any inconvenience.
I sat looking at him. His hands were folded down, one on each arm of his chair. He stared on into the abyss, invisible to me, which opened at his feet.
Arthur said, I think you'll be both too mature and too young to know the fears and nervousness, in their way not unlike those of infancy, which can come on with increasing age. I suspect, too, being so like my own father in appearance, that you yourself may never succumb to this form of trepidation, even in old age. Death may never tap you on the shoulder to expound his prologue. You may never think about it. You're kind, and please do not think I insult you. I am only very jealous, can stay impervious to most horrors and frights. Your nerve holds in battle, and if there are ever such things as ghosts or demons, you would confront them, face them down, or produce a revolver and shoot them, perhaps, back to mortal life.
Embarrassed by his accuracy, I too lowered my gaze. Where my glance fell then, I saw, across the fine Aubusson carpet, a curious Baroque shadow, thick and black, lying oddly sidelong from the lamps. What was it? Puzzled, I turned my head and looked straight up into the corner of the room. There was a slice of darkness there also, and in the dark, something, no, two things, glittered in a sudden crushed flicker of brilliancy, now yellowish, now red.
Ah,
he said, in a quiet, cracked little voice, almost sarcastic, almost bitter.
Is it there? Can you see it?
I turned back and glared at Arthur. See what, precisely?
Don't you know?
No, frankly. Of course, I'm sympathetic to what's happened to you, but even you yourself are now calling it a form of neurasthenia. So what is there to gain from dramatizing any of it further?
I can't help myself, it seems. When that clever specialist rehearsed my case before me, he mercilessly showed me exactly what I had most to fear. My own fear itself. My terrors, whether real or groundless, are my worst enemies. But I have to tell you, for such a person as myself, terror is now basic to my personality. And by refusing to let it visit me in sleep, it seems I've let it out into the concrete world, at last, where, having had me consistently elude it for so long, it has always yearned to follow me. My nightmare has become a reality, and my terror feeds it every hour. Perhaps not even only terror, either. My accustomedness.
Rubbish, I said. Utter rot. Behind me, some entity stirred. A velvet sound, edged with something rasping and barbed. Like the noise of a cat, amplified. I stood up and looked round again. Something was there. No doubt of it. In deep shadow, between the top of a wooden cupboard and the cornice of the ceiling. It looked most like a large, full trunk. It hadn't, I thought, been there previously. My conclusion was that my Uncle Arthur had become insane and was playing some type of bizarre, possibly dangerous trick on me. I've had dealings with the unstable before. The profession on whose perimeter I work has presented to me some fine examples. To humor Arthur, therefore, seemed the best course. Reluctant to stay with my back to whatever it was which had manifested in the corner, I moved my chair to a different angle, before sitting back down. Very well, I said, but you've got your answer to it, haven't you? Cast out fear. Then it will go.
I try, he said. I try. It's a war that never stops. That gypsy man who helped me in my childhood, he thought I might eventually prove the stronger, and the victory be mine. Or maybe that was his only pretense, because he could foresee what was more likely. I try, and try, and try. But the fear never goes. How can it? The evidence of what there is to fear is frequently in front of me. Besides,
By now I believe it is less fear. Then how mighty that fear it has already fed on has made the creature. How else has it done what it has? Perversely, at last, it's only in sleep I ever evade it. Others here, he said, with a weary, flat matter-of-factness, see the thing too. Oh yes, that's how actual, despite my resistance, it has become. They see it, as you just did over there, up by the ceiling. And look now, the shadow on the carpet moving, the tail of it wagging slowly to and fro.
I stared resolutely into the fire. Behind me, far off, vague, I heard a kind of soft grumbling guttural. That might only be some freak sound of the autumn wind in the chimneys. You should pack up and leave this house, I said, lighting another cigarette.
It would go with me, he said. By now it goes with me always. Sometimes it disappears, as if it has other little tasks it likes to see about the place. Then it's there again. My housekeeper has seen it. You can ask her. She's decided it's the ghost of a dog that once lived here. And my butler. The cook and maid somehow generally refuse to see it. Those that do sometimes complain of a large cat that has got into the main house from the kitchen.
There was a long, slippery, heavy noise. Arthur's eyes went over above me. I saw him watch something move quickly across the upper air. His face was green again, but again he smiled. He nodded. He said,
"It's gone for the moment. I could see them then. The welts on its side. Poor thing. It must suffer. Poor damnable thing."
I'd had enough. I got up again and said, "Sir, I have a very busy schedule, which begins quite early tomorrow. I understood you were aware of that when you invited me here. This matter, whatever it is beyond me. I don't know what you expect me to do."
"Only to listen. What else is feasible? I'd ask you to shoot it, if that were any good. But how could it be? It came out of the dark inside me, the dark where we go in dreams. It wants to take me back there, to keep me, to play with, perhaps, or only to fulfill its function, rend me, devour me, like the hapless Christians in the book."
"You'll have to excuse me," I said. "It's midnight. Perhaps I could ring for your man. Do you have any opiates to help you sleep?"
"Yes, go to bed,"
Arthur replied. His face was icy with disgust. I stood in the doorway of the smoking room. The hall outside was rosily low-lit from a single lamp standing on a table. At the curve of the staircase, one of the maids was crossing, with an armful of what looked like table linen, to the base door giving on the servants' area. I looked at her, her trim, brisk figure, and how, just before she reached the base, something loped across her path, from shade to shadow, and she hesitated, as if to check the fall of one of the pile of linen she held, which were not slipping at all. I saw its eyes gleam fitfully. It glanced at me, indifferent. In its half-seen, solid shape was all the intangible presence of the night. But as he had said, it was an indoor beast, a beast of locked houses that left only one door open for it, in the frantic hope it might go out and lose itself. A beast, too, of the indoors of the brain, the psyche. A beast of the indoors of the human soul. Like a scene from a play, I saw it. His dream, and how the beast leaped at him, missed him, always missing, as he fled outward to the world. And then his fear coming out of him, rejected, but still inextricably attached, externalized. The lion had gone around the corner, and the maid passed through the servant's door, and the hall was empty. I walked back into the smoking room. He was sitting quietly, crying, poor old child, with the welts of horror blistering on his side. "All right, old chap," I said. "All right."
"I don't," he said apologetically, "want to be alone."
"Then you shan't be. Hang the theater. I'll deal with it tomorrow." After a while, we went upstairs, and along one of the corridors to his room. Nothing was about, all was silence, and in the cracks of windows, where curtains didn't quite meet, a low moon floated on a cloud. We had another brandy,
and he went to bed, or at least lay down with the coverlet over him. His round, fallen face on the pillow stared at me.
"Nothing can be done. I know that," he said. "When it comes back..."
"I'll wake you," I said. "Sleep for now." I'd asked myself if it could come in when he slept, but of course it could. That was the whole point of it now. It was in the world, and outside of him. And his former fear of meeting it in his mind had been replaced, not unreasonably, by the fear it would eventually seize him while he slept. The electric light on the upper floors was dimmer. I sat in an armchair in this duller glow, and midnight passed into one. And so on through two. I smoked, and watched the clock, and wished I'd thought to bring some coffee upstairs. But even so, I was wide awake. Arthur slept deep and dumb. He might have been dead. I couldn't help thinking that. I had no inspiration of what I could do. Keep the creature off him. Then in the morning drive him somewhere. Look up any one of a number of people who dealt in fractured minds and hallucinations. God knows. The brain ticks away in its back rooms often, and we're unaware of its secret progress. I sincerely hoped it might offer me a plan, but hadn't much faith it could. For I knew, too, of course I did. This now was more than a dream or mirage. I'd seen it. I'm prosaic enough, and it was merely pragmatic now to admit to having seen it. To deny the situation further would be to enter myself the lists of the fanciful or mad. It returned when the clock said 3:15. It came up through the floor. That was like a stage effect. Something clever with traps and levers, but involving no dry ice to mask it. Arrived, it shook itself. The housekeeper had convinced herself it was a phantom dog, and there was something dog-like about it, certainly, as there often is with the big cats, tigers, panthers, and the rest. But its face was savage and evil, its eyes two mindless sumps of decayed fire that seemed to have given off the smoke of its mane. It did faintly stink, as he'd said. How had he known, as a child, what it might smell of? But perhaps lions don't smell of meat. It was only something he'd heard, and so made this one do it. For it was all his own work, his, and that of the artist who first so luridly depicted it and its kind, in the arena of Nero. I promised him I would wake him when it came back. I called his name sharply, and Arthur opened his eyes, instantly fully conscious. "Is it there?" Across the room by the window. The moon had gone, but the low-burning electric light illustrated the lion as accurately as its initial paint. It did not look at him or me. It looked about itself, at the massively furnished room. Then it padded away, across the floor, and, nudging open the bathroom door, went inside. In the total noiselessness of the night, Arthur and I listened as it drank from some trickle of water, real or etheric, issuing from the taps of the bath. When it had finished, it returned, not through the door but simply out of the wall. It stood, its heavy head lowered, its tail swinging. Something struck me then. I couldn't have described it, but abruptly I saw the cruelty in its face was only instinct, and perhaps the pain from the stripes on its side, which anyway looked partly cured. It was an animal of sorts, at least. It was hungry, and had been thirsty, and chose sometimes to use a door rather than pass through a blank floor or wall. So then I spoke to it, by its name. "Lion." It made a snorting noise, and turned, and looked at me. That terrible look. The hellish eyes that were really only reflecting light. "There he is," I said to it. "There. Look there." And the head again turned, as if it grasped my meaning. And I saw Arthur brace himself. I said to Arthur then, "It's yours. You made it. You gave it life. You're like a father to the damn thing, Arthur. Stop resisting it, do you hear? It's your belonging now, whatever it was to start with. It doesn't want to drag you back into the shadows. If it did, it would lose all this new territory you've given it. I'm fairly sure it knows that, or it would have done it by now. After all, it's had a couple of months to try. First, you gave it the Roman arena to play in, but now it's got a whole house,
and anything outside it fancies too. Why do you think it goes off and leaves you? It goes exploring like a bloody cat. And why do you think it follows you, comes back to you? If it isn't for violence, it must be something else. Maybe that's where it is like a dog. It knows if you don't. It belongs to you. The lion, with no warning, sprang. It was too quick for Arthur even to cry out, even to register his fear. It landed and balanced on his bed, at the foot of it, gazing at him, breathing. I crossed the room in three strides and pushed it hard in its unmarked side, except there was nothing, nothing substantial to push. But with a grunt it dropped and flopped down. It lay there sprawled. It blinked at me, growling. "Be quiet," I said. "You must do as you're told. If you want to stay, you must behave yourself." The growl changed to a yawn. We remained watching it, Arthur bolt upright on the pillows, I standing at the bedside, and after a while it lowered its head onto the coverlet, the horror of its eyes shut. After that, we kept vigil till first light, talking slowly and methodically, discussing it, over its sleeping form, Arthur not moving an inch, I static in a chair. When dawn began to seep in, the lion woke and rose. It kicked its paws and jumped off the bed, and vanished. At 6:50 some tea was brought up by a maid, and I went down to telephone the town, reporting my absence as due to food poisoning. The lion was standing in the echoing hallway when I turned, looking off along a corridor to a narrow open door. The morning smelled enticingly there, of trees and mist and bonfires, while the open door, since the lion could utilize blank walls for exits and entrances, was presumably an aesthetic choice. Outside lay the grounds, with plenty of game, mice and squirrels, birds, rabbits and hares. Any big animal could hunt for itself if it wanted, although I doubted any of the hunted things would suffer much worse than a nasty shock. The lion, though it was visible and could create smell and sound, had no actual substance. But, like the bath taps, which didn't leak but had provided water, an idea was conceivably enough for it to feed from. A beast of imagination in more than one way. Arthur's beast, very apparently. Even as I watched, it made a decision and bounded off along the corridor and out of the open door. Hungry, well, it had had to wait several decades for a meal. Needless to say, I recounted nothing of any of this when I reached the theater the next day. My assistant had managed pretty ably without me, and all was soon put in order. I meanwhile secured myself a room in the local hotel. Arthur survived another 25 years, and died without warning, but peacefully, during a fishing holiday in Scotland with one of his partners in the marmalade venture. There had been some talk of a large ghost dog, I believe, being seen oft about Blue Furze, and also in other houses where Arthur visited. A slight mythology had connected itself to my uncle, who apparently was once or twice spotted, as witnesses thought, throwing sticks for some large hound in a selection of rural retreats. In Scotland, years before he died, there was a strange story of something lying on the foot of his bed purring, but it had disappeared by the time others came to investigate. After Arthur's death, the beast vanished completely, at least according to his housekeeper. Blue Furze is now, I rather ashamedly admit, mine, but I am seldom there. Nevertheless, those who rent the property relate nothing either of dogs, cats, or lions. From Arthur, in the years before his death, I heard very little of anything, and less of his creature. With his renewed sense of safety, our estrangement had recurred, which seemed to suit us both. Only a postscript appeared now and then to a rare letter. The lion is in good spirits. Anyone reading this correspondence might take it that Arthur referred sportively to himself. People told me afterwards my solitary visit had done him a power of good. He had thrown off at once his old timidity and depression, and the recent bad nerves. Instead, he took to long, hale walks, and large cuts of meat served almost raw at dinner, though these were barely touched. Sometimes, when alone, he would, it seems, laugh aloud. He informed anybody who asked him it was at something he had read in a newspaper. Naturally, I have no knowledge of where either of them is now. For myself, I assume life ends with the body, But then again, perhaps there are some mind-fashioned heavens in which certain mentally creative people continue to exist. If so, I don't think for a moment Arthur and his lion are now locked back in any Roman arena. He freed the lion, and ultimately was set free by it. Trite in the paucity of my own imaginative knack, I see them bounding along a seaside. Arthur, a gleeful kid of 7, wiry, healthy and tough, and with a great black mane dog, scarred a little on one flank, whose claws flash like silver hooks, and leave starry markers on the clean, unearthly sand of the shore.
Pride. Mary A. Terzillo.
Mary Terzillo's fiction has recently appeared in Analog, Year's Best Lesbian Fiction 2008, Cat Tales, Space and Time, The Vampire Archives, and Sky, Whales, and Other Wonders. She has published about 50 stories in magazines and anthologies, and her poetry is collected in Your Cat and Other Space Aliens. Her Nebula-winning Mars is No Place for Children, and her novel, An Old-Fashioned Martian Girl, have been selected as recreational reading on the International Space Station. Terzillo says, like many of my stories, pride comes out of my life as a professor at Trumbull Branch of Kent State University. Residents of Trumbull County, Ohio, love their exotic pets. Two sisters in one of my classes told me they had adopted a lion cub, which liked to bask in the middle of their residential street, forcing traffic to drive around it. A philosophy professor had to give up his pet python to get custody of his young son. A little girl was mauled by a tiger cub at the county fair. A friend of my son always dreaded the part of his paper route that took him past a caged animal he never saw, but that roared terrifyingly. And of course, there was Iron Mike Tyson's fruitless suit to keep Kenya, his white Bengal tiger, plus other big cats, on his 60-acre estate in rural Southington, only a few miles from where I lived. To understand Jonesy, I've watched countless bored, scary big cats in Busch Gardens, the Cleveland Zoo, and other zoological gardens, contemplating their casual menace. Jonesy's roll and strike attack is based on speculations of the way saber-tooth cats tore out the throats of their prey. But the truth is, I've observed my kitten, Mahasamatman, make the same move play attacking another cat.
The hot fur thing under Kevin's shirt clawed at his chest. Nice going, he thought. First the bum rap for weed, and now, if I don't get caught stealing lab animals, I'll get rabies from this freak. Frankenlab, at FrankenU, a.k.a. Franklin Agricultural College, was messing with animals, electrodes in their brains, cloning them like Dolly the Sheep, except not regular animals, dead animals from frozen meat. And they were going to kill the animals. He couldn't save them all, those fuzzy orange-furred mice. Most wouldn't make it. Those guys from Animals Our Brethren had pried open cages, and when the mice wouldn't come out, they shook them out, and when the mice squeed, cowering under lab tables, they kicked them until they ran into corners, and from there may God have mercy on their itty souls. Kevin petted the little monster through his shirt, but it writhed around and gummed him. "I'm saving your life, dumb ox!" He dashed out of the building minutes before alarms brought the fire department. Kevin had been in trouble before. A year ago, his girlfriend's cousin Ed and he had been cruising around in Ed's van, which had expired plates. Kevin didn't know about the baggie of pot under the driver's seat. When the state patrol started following, Ed asked Kevin to switch places. His license, like the plates, was expired, he said. They switched, veering madly on a lonely stretch of 422. When they finally stopped and the cops asked to search the van, Kevin shrugged and said okay.
"And whose is this?"
Ed said.
"Not me."
Kevin was too surprised to look properly surprised, and this was a zero-tolerance state. So Ed got off with a warning, and Kevin, stuck with court-appointed counsel, served 30 days. Kevin had been looking for a job to pay for college when local papers broke the story that some 1,000-odd animals, mostly admittedly mice, would be killed because their experiment was over. What was he thinking of? He wasn't an animal rights kind of dude. Still, he felt panicked exultation fleeing the scene of the crime. He struggled to control his Pinto while driving with the squirming thing scratching inside his shirt. He fumbled the back door key and pounded downstairs to the basement, where he pulled the light cord above the laundry tub and took the fur ball out of his shirt. Oh, God, what have they done to you? It was deformed. Big head. Chopped off tail. Cat? Dog? A mix? He deposited it in the laundry tub. Boggling at the size of its mouth, he realized it needed food. Now. Forward-pointing eyes, meat-eater, he ran upstairs and grabbed a raw chicken breast from the fridge. He held it out to the cub. The cub flopped down on its belly in the tub and tried to howl. All that came out was a squeak. He tried to stuff the meat into its mouth, but it flinched away and lay looking at him, sides heaving. Maybe the mother chewed the food up for it. Mother? Not hardly. This thing didn't have a mother. It was fucking hatched in Frankenlab. Raised in farm country, Kevin liked animals. He sometimes even petted Rosebud, the town pit bull, when Rosebud wasn't into tearing people's arms off. If his parents had been rich, he'd be pre-veterinary at Franken U, or a cattle rancher, or a discoverer of rare snakes. He retrieved a knife from upstairs, hacked tidbits off the chicken breast, and put them in the cub's mouth. The cub sucked on them, famished. It got to its feet and seized his finger with its front paws. Head held sideways, it chomped down on his finger. It did have a few teeth, it seemed. He jerked away. "Stop it, you little monster!" Then he realized he might wake his mother. Kevin, it's a baby, duh. Where would he get a baby bottle? He opened a can of condensed milk from the pantry, dipped a chicken chunk in it, and let the monster suck milk off the meat. 20 minutes later, it either got satisfied or gave up. Its little belly looked marginally bigger, and the can was empty, mostly spilled on the laundry tub or his shirt. It stretched, and unsheathed claws way too big for a little guy the size of a raccoon. Kevin thought, it'll purr now. Instead, it washed its face, running front paws over those deformed big jaws. And then, just when Kevin decided it was almost cute, it reached out a claw and pricked his arm, not enough to hurt, just to say, "More?" "You're beginning to tick me off," he said. The cub's gaze radiated adoration. It licked his hand, nearly rasping his skin off. Its fur was golden retriever blonde, its eyes the color of river moss. Green-eyed blonde, like Sarah. Dappled coat, like freckles on Sarah's sweet shoulders. Sarah Jones. They were almost a couple before his arrest. Now she acted distant. The monster leapt out of the tub and landed on the floor. It shook itself, surprised at the fall. He lay down and stared at it eye to eye. You need a name. He was furious that they planned to kill it. It was harmless. Maybe not harmless. Planning to get big, judging from those paws, each the size of cheeseburgers, but innocent. What the hell have I got myself into? He asked it. Its grotesque little face shone with trust. With the knife he'd used to cut the chicken, and thinking of Sarah Jones, he tapped the little monster on each shoulder and said, I dub thee Sir Jonesy. For a week, he kept Jonesy locked in the root cellar. His mom either didn't know or pretended not to. Rosebud, Mr. Turnbull's pit bull, kept getting off his chain and sneaking over to paw at the basement door. There was an article in the paper about the lab fire, but the lab animals were hardly mentioned. The scientists downplayed it all. The animals had been slated for sacrifice. Dr. Betty Hartley said, Federal regulations require that animals be euthanized at the end of an experiment, she said, plus the money had run out. Cold. Sacrifice. Nice euphemism. Like, put to sleep. Like anything ever woke up from that sleep. Sacrifice? What were they going to do, dance around an altar and beg God to protect them from weird-ass animal zombies? Dr. Hartley said she was sad that the animals had all died in the fire.